Spiked is free. We have no paywall. You don't have to subscribe to read our articles or listen to our podcasts. We want as many people as possible to have access to our content, and so we are determined to keep Spiked free. And we're only able to do that thanks to the generosity of our readers and our listeners. Your donations mean we can carry on doing what we're doing and provide an essential alternative voice on the big issues of the day. This is particularly important during the COVID crisis, in which Spiked has provided the space for lockdown skeptics, dissenting experts, and others to say things that have become unsayable elsewhere. So thank you to everyone who donates to Spiked. If you don't yet donate, but you would like to, please consider doing so today. One-off donations are always hugely appreciated, but even better are regular monthly donations. Even £5 a month, less than the cost of a copy of The Guardian and a cappuccino, can make a huge difference to our work. So, to help keep Spiked free and thriving, go to www.spiked-online.com and hit the big red donate button. Now, on with the show.
This isn't really the bad bit. This is annoying. This is a period during which people have grown used to being told what to do in a way that they never ought to have done, in my view. Then, when, to whatever extent this ever is over, it's over and we're allowed back, and we discover and see the desolation of the economy, and then will be the moment when the real reckoning comes. And this is the thing everybody, I think, fears. And what are people going to make of it when they find that those jobs which they thought they'd had, or which they'd been paid for by the government, just aren't there anymore?
Hello and welcome to The Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill. This is a podcast in which an esteemed guest joins me to talk about the big ideas, the bad ideas, the problems and the controversies of life in the early 21st century. In this episode, I am delighted to be joined by Peter Hitchens. Peter is a columnist for The Mail on Sunday. He has also written for The Spectator, First Things and The American Conservative. He has written numerous books, including The Abolition of Britain, The Rage Against God, and The Phony Victory, The World War II Illusion. Over the past year, Peter has become one of the most prominent and consistent critics of the lockdown and our loss of liberty. And he has continually posed the question of what will become of Britain after this authoritarian experiment. Peter, I want to start off by asking you about the political climate we find ourselves in at the moment in this late stage lockdown Britain, because it seems to me politically it's getting worse and worse. And anyone now who raises any questions whatsoever about the lockdown, the efficacy of lockdown, the wisdom of lockdown, even how long lockdown will go on, is rounded upon and denounced and demonized and in some cases shunted from polite society. What do you make of this climate? How bad do you think it's got in terms of having a reasonable, free discussion about what we've done in relation to COVID?
I think it is bad and rapidly getting worse. I think that the whole debate, such as there is a debate at all, is being shifted away from, is this worth doing or was it the right thing to do, to people are dying, why don't you shut up? If you don't shut up, more people will die and it will be your fault. And what's more, it's probably your fault for going out into your garden this morning, or even your fault for going out for a walk that was slightly too long, or perhaps sitting down, something which Michael Gove, for instance, seems to disapprove of. It's all our fault. It will be our fault for having had Christmas. It will be our fault for having spoken to anybody or met anybody. So the government has now appropriated all virtue. We have given all our virtues to the government, and as a result, they can tell us absolutely what to do, and it no longer wants to hear anything from us whatsoever. And I think there are quite a lot of people who are being understandably intimidated by this. My resolve is that when pushed around in this fashion, I push back. And I return yet again to the fundamental question, which has been unanswered since the beginning: is this justified? Is it proportionate? And my continuing answer is I've seen absolutely nothing to suggest that it is either justified or proportionate or the right response to it. And I care just as much about people dying as anybody else. Thank you very much. And don't you dare tell me otherwise.
That has got to be one of the slimiest methods that is used to silence dissent, this notion that even to raise questions is to virtually kill people. The other way in which people try to shut you down is through the use of the word denier. This is one of my least favorite aspects of the contemporary discussion, because the notion that you're a COVID denier, firstly, most people that is said about it is not true. Most of the experts or the critical voices fully accept that COVID-19 is a real virus and is a problem and poses a challenge to our country. But it seems to me that that word is used as a way of demonizing anyone who raises questions to such an extent that they're put on a par with Holocaust deniers, essentially. They're put on a par with the worst people you can imagine who are denying the obvious truth in front of our noses. Have you been referred to as a denier, and how do you respond to that?
Oh, only about 30 times a day, I should think. I respond to it by saying it's a revolting dog whistle slur designed to suggest that the person involved is equivalent to those who deny that the Shoah took place. Something which is so repulsive that the moment you're associated with it, you're already in trouble. One of the first principles of political argument is James Carville's great warning that while you're explaining, you're losing. So my response to this is not to explain. If anybody actually thinks that I am a denier of the Holocaust, then let them say so somewhere public where we can deal with it, okay? If they don't think it, then don't say it. If they really do think it, let them say it and let's see what happens. My response to this is disgusting behavior. It is poisoning the wells, as I think Cardinal Newman put it in one of his debates in the 19th century. It's not, poisoning the wells is a term people forget what it means. It was a tactic of warfare considered so low that even in the Middle Ages, there was a sort of Geneva Convention against poisoning wells. It is a disgusting thing to do. What you're basically saying, I'm not prepared to argue with you. I would rather slur and slander you than argue. And anybody who does that is immediately, in my view, in so many other ways people do this, admitting that they have no case. But when you hear it, you know that the people who are using it against you are worried by your very existence. And that's another problem. I saw that skeptics of the lockdown being described by a certain commentator early on today as dangerous. I challenged him. I said, you're not saying our ideas are dangerous. You're saying we're dangerous. And this is a direct staircase to the Shoah trial. And once a person is dead, what do you do with a dangerous person or a dangerous thing? You confine them, you destroy them, you get rid of them. It's a use of language which is immediately takes us out of the whole sphere of rational government, which is based on limited government and based on adversarial parliaments, in which your opponent has to be granted the presumption that he has the right and the freedom to say what he wishes to say and to be heard courteously and listened to. Because for the very good reason that governments which don't have a coherent, strong oppositions are invariably bad governments because they don't have enough internal criticism to foresee danger and they mess things up. It's actually, bizarrely, it's one of the many areas in which virtue also turns out to be efficient. If you allow freedom of speech and thought, you're better governed than if you don't. And it's a turn away. During wartime, people are inclined to be, how shall I put it, run things at a higher temperature, and you might make excuses for some sort of restriction of speech. So I myself would be reluctant to do it, especially in a war in the name of freedom. But in peacetime, there is no excuse at all for this sort of thing. And I really think the only thing to do is to hit back at it very hard when it's level there, to say, this is not merely not true, but the person who does it is demeaning himself.
One of the things I have been most shocked by in relation to that culture you're describing is the bile that has been thrown at actual experts. So you have the likes of Professor Carol Sikora, Sunitra Gupta of Oxford University, others who have raised questions about the lockdown or who have proposed alternatives to the lockdown in terms of the Great Barrington Declaration or other ways of shielding vulnerable people. What has been said and done to them over the past few weeks in particular has been genuinely shocking. And you use the word show trial, which I don't think is an exaggeration. I mean, there has at least been a media show trial of some of these people. And a writer for The Observer described them as agents of disinformation, which strikes me as libelous, apart from anything else. Disinformation doesn't mean getting things wrong. It means purposefully deceiving the public for wicked ends. So the thing that worries me about that climate in particular, the way in which even dissenting expert voices, so we're not talking about some idiot in the street talking about 5G, which I think they should be allowed to do. We're talking about dissenting experts. What do you think that does to the culture of skepticism and the importance of skepticism, particularly in a time like this?
I am concerned about it, what it does to the culture of skepticism, but I'm much more concerned about it, what it does to respect for the scientific method. And the whole idea which we've had really since the Enlightenment, that the pursuit of true knowledge is one of the fundamental tasks, particularly the academy, and therefore anybody who sets out in pursuit of real knowledge by experiment, which is what science is fundamentally about, and is wholly objective and must tell the truth, even if it's to their own disadvantage, even if it destroys their own treasured theories. If they find by objective experiment that they were previously wrong, they have to say so. And those who weren't involved in the experiment, who've also been found to be wrong, have to concede it too. This is how human knowledge advances. And here we have a complete barricade placed across the road of advancing knowledge. If you have the wrong opinion in a scientific debate over things which are not settled, then you are not to be listened to. You are to be derided and in some cases insulted. Now, many scientists, in the nature of what they do, are personally diffident people. They live in the laboratory, in the quiet pursuit of truth. They're not, in many cases, there are exceptions to this, they're not in many cases particularly equipped for the hurly-burly of severe and brutal debate at the best of times. But at a time like this, when the issues are in fact very large, it's extremely distressing to see people of this kind treated in this fashion. And I'm sure when they emerge, as I think they very reluctantly do in many cases, from their laboratories and their libraries to say what they wish to say, and they're greeted with these jets of slime being directed at them, they are hopelessly dismayed. This is a great blow at the pursuit of knowledge, and a great blow at the Enlightenment, and a great blow at civilization. And of course it is also, as we were discussing earlier, but there's little point in repeating it, a great blow at freedom, which seems to me to be diminishing visibly all around us as we speak. Now, some people don't care about freedom. I've become more and more convinced over the past several years in many, many disputes that I've got involved in that people don't actually value freedom as much as they pretend to, and our society doesn't actually put a very high price on it. I happen to do so, but that makes me unusual in my experience. So I'm not especially surprised after the various surrenders of freedom on what I regard as the pretext for counterterrorism, for instance. I'm not terribly surprised to find that people aren't rushing in their masses to defend it. And I've never really, since much after about 2 or 3 weeks of this, imagined that we who doubt what the government is doing would ever achieve anything remotely resembling a majority. All we could do would be to sustain a dissenting minority of perhaps 15% of the population who continue to say, actually, we don't agree with this. And I thought that was very important. And also very important that it should be represented in Parliament, because once dissent goes, the government becomes all-powerful. And we see in many countries, formerly free, the extraordinarily stringent regulation of human life now underway, which I think has not happened here so far because there was still a fairly robust dissent. And I think it may well be that those who wish to go further see that robust dissent as something which needs now to be dispersed and sent to its homes so that other and more oppressive measures can be applied. But as long as dissent still lives, it will be hard for them to do that. And that may be the reason for the intensity of the attacks going on.
I wanted to ask you about the reason for the intensity, because I think that's actually something really worth thinking about. And you touched upon it earlier, I think, which is there's a defensiveness here, because very often censorship rises from people's inability to justify a position they're taking or to justify a policy they want to enforce. And the less capable they become to justify their course of action, usually the more hysterical they become in clamping down on dissent, lest they be exposed as the fools that they are. So I think a lot of the intensity of the clampdown on intellectual dissent really comes from an inability to defend lockdown as a policy. And I wanted to ask you about the efficacy of lockdown. I know that's a very broad question, so we can dig down into it. But it strikes me that asking questions about lockdown is absolutely essential. It seems to me very obvious that it is not a sustainable or successful policy. We're on our third one. The first and the second ones clearly didn't do what they were intended to do. The third one probably won't either. How can it be that we have a policy that we do again and again and again without the desired or predicted outcome, and yet even asking questions about that becomes virtually impossible?
Oh, but that's easy to answer. People who have decided that they believe in something in a dogmatic fashion, and I've been one of those people, can very rapidly turn the world into a circular place where everything that happens, either failure or success, justifies what happens. So if the lockdown is followed by diminished numbers of deaths, then it will be said that it succeeded. If it's not followed by diminishing numbers of deaths, then it will be said that this is because people didn't observe it properly. If during, as is going on now, as I understand it, I haven't seen anything contradict this, if influenza largely disappears from sight during this period, then it will be said that this is because people have so effectively been washing their hands and wearing their masks and staying at home. Yet somehow or other, this doesn't have the same effect on COVID. Anybody who wants to believe something will believe it. And I would just rebut your use of the word fools earlier. I don't think we're dealing with fools. I think almost all the people who are in favor of this are intelligent. And I also think that they're mostly well-intentioned. But they are very full of what I regard as a utopian belief, that they can actually, and you see this reflected sometimes in newspaper cartoons, that the virus is a sort of physical enemy, like the Germans or Saddam Hussein, which can be defeated, which is, I think, ahistorical and unscientific, but it is a thing. People love to be pitched against a wicked enemy whom they can defeat. And these people think they're engaged in something very like a crusade or some sort of moral activity. And therefore, they're extraordinarily difficult to divert them from it because they're not really open to argument. You have to get into their closed circle to be considered worthwhile. Just as in the run-up to the Iraq War, everybody in Whitehall who knew anything about Iraq or indeed much about the Middle East or about Islam would have said, if anybody had asked them, look, this is a crazy thing to do. But as soon as it became clear that that's how they felt, then they were excluded from the most important discussions and nobody listened to them. And I've no doubt there are plenty of people in government who are very skeptical about this. I sometimes think when you see these big government press conferences with lots of experts, that some of the signaling in some of the things they say a certain amount of proper scientific skepticism about what's going on. But they can't, for the sake of their future employment, say it openly and out loud, because the government is now in this rage of intolerance against anybody who disagrees. So I think really the only way to argue against it is to oppose it. But there is another thing I have found about arguing with the people who get really angry with me are almost invariably those who have the same doubts that I have, but who are suppressing them and who are annoyed that I'm expressing their own doubts. I think, again, because of the intelligence of many of these people, they must have doubts, and they don't like hearing them expressed. But none of that matters to me much anymore. I don't think I hope to persuade them anymore. The people I hope to persuade are those who hold the eventual inquiry, because the thing that we really have to do is to make sure that at the inquiry, the possibility is at least considered that the lockdown policy was a mistake. Otherwise, it will simply be a consideration of whether we should have done it sooner, which may well be the danger. But unless that argument that the whole thing may have been a mistake is kept alive now, it'll be very hard to raise it when the inquiry comes. And that's my long-term objective, is to make sure that doubt remains alive and is considered.
So you are not a COVID denier, as is very clear, and you've established that in the many things you've written. You are, however, a lockdown skeptic or a lockdown opponent. So let's imagine you are at this future inquiry and you are asked to explain why you think the lockdown was the wrong thing to do back in March last year and every month since then in various different ways. How would you respond to that?
I think that one has to start, again, this is the use of the scientific method here. It's not incumbent on me or on any other skeptic to show why this is wrong. It will be incumbent on those who favored it to show why it was right. There are two things they need to do. One, they need to show, which I don't believe has ever been shown, that there is any causal relationship between the stringency of these national shutdowns and strangulations and the number of deaths. And deaths going down. I just think there isn't any. And this needs to be in an international context because many countries have dealt with this in many different ways, and they really do need to be examined. And all the studies that I've seen have shown there is not even any congruence between the stringency of action and the outcome. So if you haven't even got a correlation, then how are you going to put forward the case for causation? I think we need to start from an absolutely blank sheet on that and insist on that. The second separate argument, which should be put separately and in a separate session, is this: even if this has been successful in reducing the number of COVID deaths, which, as I say, is in doubt, even if it has been, was it justified on any serious cost-benefit analysis, or was the cost of it in the long term to our lives in general, in the cost of it to people who missed treatments and operations and died or suffered serious illness as a result, in the people whose educations have been more or less shipwrecked, in the enormously increased poverty and unhappiness, which has undoubtedly been brought about, in the loneliness that it created in the lives of the healthy old, which has been very physically bad for them as well as mentally bad for them. In all these ways, can it possibly be justified in terms of whatever effect it can measurably be said to have had? And again, I think the answer must be no. The old argument is this is like burning down your house to get rid of a wasp's nest. Needs to be brought up because that still seems to me to be a very good parallel, not least because it appears that the wasps are about the only survivors of this conflagration.
On the cost-benefit analysis point that you make there, I think one of the most remarkable things of the current moment is the reluctance to have a serious cost-benefit analysis off lockdown. I mean, fleeting mentions have been made off the potential impact of lockdown on the economy, on people's lives, on mental health. Every now and then there are a certain campaign group will say, well, we're worried about breast cancer rates or we're worried about mental health among the young. But any argument that there should be a concerted, possibly centralized study of the cost benefit of analysis of this policy that is impacting on every single person's life are always shot down. And in fact, they get folded into the COVID denier narrative. Anyone who wants to focus too much on the lockdown is kind of lumped in with that group of people. What do you think explains that reluctance? Do you think there's a knowledge on some people's part that these consequences are indeed severe and they want to not conspiratorially hide them away, but at least suppress discussion about them for the time being? Or do you just think it's that almost fundamentalist marriage to the ideology of lockdown, which means they can't even countenance a serious discussion?
Can we come on to the ideology or otherwise of lockdown after I've answered this question? I think it's quite plain that a cost-benefit analysis on all the evidence which we've had, very interesting contribution by Michael Joffe, a pediatrician in Canada, on a former lockdown enthusiast now, an opponent, having examined this in his own part of the world. But I don't think anybody can really doubt that a cost-benefit analysis on the basis of what we know already is going to come down and say that this has been enormously costly for very little, if any, good results. So you can see why people want to avoid doing that, because they've got the power to say no. And at the moment, an enfeebled parliament has not got the power to make them do it. No one can doubt that the Whitehall machine has the ability, if it were asked to do it at the proper level, to do a cost-benefit analysis. It can't be because they know how to do it. It can't also be because they haven't got anybody free to do it, because it's not as if you can retrain senior civil servants in medical procedures and send them out in the hospitals. They might as well be doing that as anything else. So I think if they just know that it will be bad, so they hope the demand for it to happen will go away. And that's another reason, of course, to misrepresent dissenters as saboteurs who don't care about death and suffering. And it's a terrible, feeble argument, but the trouble with a lot of terrible, feeble arguments is that they work. I have a great recollection when I was in the Hampstead Labour Party. I lost every single vote at my ward on every subject that I'd ever, ever, ever done. And then one day I thought, well, I'll use their methods against them. And one of my opponents was foolish enough to use the word enabling act. She said that something she was going to do would require an enabling act. And I said, comrades, listen to this. This comrade refers to an enabling act. Does she not know that it was Hitler who used it? And I had my audience in the palm of my hand. For the first time, I won a vote by being totally unscrupulous and dishonest. She had nothing in common with Hitler. She had a good deal more in common with Trotsky. But the truth is that unscrupulousness wins arguments if you're prepared to do it. And I did it as an experiment, and I have to say I would not do it again, because any fruits won by these methods are Dead Sea fruits, which turn to dust and ashes in the mouth. And you shouldn't do it anyway. It's just wrong. But I'm afraid it works, and that's why they do it. But on the side of ideology of lockdown, I don't think there is an ideology of lockdown. What there is, however, and growing in our society, is a very, very strong utopian streak, which is, in my view, has grown out of the collapse of the Christian religion in the Western world, and its replacement, because when great things fall, they don't just fall and leave an empty space. Other things rush in to fill the space. There's a huge part of the human soul and mind which wants to do something good. Mm. And people offered the opportunity to do something good in many, many ways. A turn increasingly to utopian means, whether it's the utopians who thought they could solve the Middle East by invading Iraq, or the utopians who we're all familiar with who believe that man-made global warming can be reversed by the measures which we won't go into now, or huge numbers of other activists. People, the utopianism is very, very common. And in this case, after a long period of cultural revolution, in which all the old sort of grumpy common sense nuisance features of a free society and limited government, all the people who said, no, actually, minister, you can't do that. No, actually, I'm sorry, the law won't permit you. No, the newspapers will never let you get away with that. All these breaks on utopian fancies have turned out to be paper tigers. And they've been weakened for a long time. But the great experience of the past 9 months has been that there are no safeguards in this country at all against somebody who wants to exercise power in what he claims to be a benevolent cause. And we are naked in the face of any competent utopian who wants to impose his will on us. And that's where we are now. It's not, there's been no conspiracy before anybody accused me of that. It's just as in the absence of Christianity, utopianism is becoming incredibly important. In the decay of institutions, the restraints on government have vanished. And we're now in that great state in Robert Bolt's Man for All Seasons, where Thomas More asks his interrogator, would you flatten all the laws in England to go after the devil? And his interrogator replies, yes. Well, where then, if the devil comes after you, where will you seek refuge? The law's all being flat. But it's all gone. And one of the most significant events, apart from the total feebleness of Parliament and most of the media, one of the most significant events in the past 6 months has been the refusal of the courts to contemplate a judicial review of what's been going on. One of the most huge developments in politics and power, certainly as big as anything. I actually thought Gina Miller's cases, the first one particularly, were entirely legitimate. I thought both of them should have been heard by the courts. And I think that the Simon Dolan case was at least as big as, and in my view, probably more important than either of the Gina Miller cases. So why wouldn't they hear it? But it went right the way up to the Supreme Court, and the answer at every stage was nit. We're not even hearing it. Not we're turning you down and saying that we won't review it. We're not even hearing a case for judicial review of this. It's ridiculous.
On what you've just described there very well, the institutional decay that leaves us in a situation where we have very few legal or political guards against the kind of onslaught on liberty that we've seen over the past 9 months. I wanted to ask you about that kind of question, because it seems to me that what we're currently living through has been a long time coming. I mean, it's been a long time coming, not only in terms of institutional decay, but also politically, and a lot of the ideas that have taken form this year seem to me to precede the arrival of COVID-19. You know, the apocalypticism, for example, of the climate change movement seems to have morphed into an apocalypticism surrounding COVID. You know, the whole ideology of the safe space, precautionary principle, protecting yourself from others, keeping your distance. You know, some people have said that the elites have been socially distancing from ordinary people for far longer than COVID has existed. So do you think we're living through a perfect storm of the kinds of things that you've been raising the alarm bells about for the past few years, which have really conflated in 2020 and 2021 to give rise to the most grave assault on freedom in living memory?
It does look like it. I thought I'd be dead by the time all this stuff happened. How many people said, what should I do in the future, and what should our response be to the terrible things about the country, which I kept telling everyone was going on? I said, leave. And people laughed at me. And I'm sure that's why it's so funny now. But mind you, where is it to go? You can't get in without having a negative what's it test. And even then, when you get there, it's the same. So I didn't have some kind of prophetic vision of the future of the topless towers of Canary Wharf in flames or anything. I just thought that this country had all the makings of a failed state. Everything about it was wrong. Its laws had fallen to pieces. Its criminal justice had gone. Its economy was a tottering, inverted pyramid of piffle. Its education system was a disgrace. Its family life had gone, so the upbringing of people I just thought it was just waiting to fall in, like one of those houses that had been undermined by termites and then suddenly fall down in a whoosh all at once. But I really did think that I would be dead before this happened, and I never foresaw COVID-19, which seems to be brought it all forward. The thing is, this isn't really the bad bit. This is annoying. This is a period, a revolutionary period, during which people have grown used to being told what to do in a way that they never ought to have done, in my view. They've grown used to being reliant on the state for their income and pretty much sacrificing their own employment. They've become confined to their homes. They've been robbed of civil society. They've seen the almost complete disappearance of debate and dissent among them. Then, when to whatever extent this ever is over, it's over and we're allowed back, not liberated back into our former state, but allowed back to a sort of semblance of it, and we discover and see the desolation of the economy which has taken place, then will be the moment when the real reckoning comes. And this is the thing everybody, I think, fears. I mean, what are people going to make of it when they find that those jobs which they thought they'd had, which they've been paid for by the government, just aren't there anymore. When all those business, I look around my hometown of Oxford now, and I tremble for all the small businesses. I don't see how they're going to survive another 3 months of this. They've had enough as it is. This is the third great belting blow at them. And at the end of this, this must be confronted, as it's not being at the moment. I mean, Rishi Sunak pulling the fruit machine again and sending out another stream of fairy gold isn't real economics. It's postponement at best. That postponement does come to an end. And at that point, we really do face a position where, of course, if there is, which I fervently preach against and hope there isn't, if there is civil unrest, then, of course, that provides the moment for an even more stringent removal of liberty and imposition of state power. And there we are. What have you gained by that? That's what people say. Oh, all you can come up with is write a letter to your MP, is it? Well, that's pretty feeble, isn't it? Well, indeed, it is, I'm afraid. Feeble, but it's lawful. And if you did it, it would have an effect. And it is something that you could do or could have done. And at the end of this, anybody who hasn't done this should be ashamed of themselves for not even trying, because Parliament is open to the influence of voters if there are enough of them interested. But I've clung so tightly to the constitutional and peaceful route, because I've thought that anything which went the other way would be so horrible and disastrous, and would, I'm absolutely certain, make it even worse. But I fear it. What do you do when people who've lived reasonable, relatively prosperous lives suddenly find themselves entangled with the joys of universal credit for the first time and discover what it is actually like in this country to be living at the pleasure of the state?
I actually wanted to ask you about the longer-term consequences of what we're currently doing. And one of the statements I found most shocking of this whole period was Neil Ferguson in his recent interview with The Times, in which he said that him and the team and various politicians, they looked at what China did in Wuhan in relation to COVID, and they had a severe lockdown, of course, and they thought to themselves, we could never get away with that here. And then Italy did something similar, and then they start to think, we could get away with it. And what was most shocking to me about that was not even necessarily the fact that British experts and politicians were sitting around thinking, can we do what the Chinese authoritarians do? Although that is obviously very shocking. But it was that phrase, get away with. And I think that really touches upon what had changed. I mean, firstly, there's a cynicism and an opportunism that exists in the upper echelons of power, but also what has changed in relation to the public. And they clearly got a sense that they could get away with treating the public as children to be locked up. And I think that told a story about a general collapse of belief in freedom, I think.
What I wish is that somebody had the opportunity to put to Professor Ferguson this question: what do you mean, get away with it? Why did you say that? Mm. I long to hear his answer. Again, I absolutely deplore personal attacks on opponents. And I'm sure that Professor Ferguson's instincts and intentions are good. I'm sure that he's doing what he regards as his best. But what did he mean by that? Mm. what was going through his mind. And I think it would be fascinating. Just, it's disturbing, partly because he said it. Did he not think that anybody would notice? That anybody might place a construction on it, which was, how shall I put it, skeptical. It was the most fascinating, and I made quite a lot of it because I thought it had been undercovered. I mean, it was a fascinating interview, but I always remember as a child reading the Daily Telegraph of Al-Ahram, the semi-official Cairo newspaper, and wondering what a semi-official newspaper was. Now I know. The Times of London is exactly that. I mean, is it a newspaper or is it a government organ? It's very hard to tell from one minute to the next. So I don't suppose Professor Fowkes never expected to get a hard time from. But the it's those cracks that the light gets in, isn't it? It was just sort of said in passing. And it was picked up by several people, including me, and made a bit more. But I think most of the population is still, as in most cases, most of this stuff, most of the population is largely unaware of the fact that he said it.
In relation to what they can get away with, I wanted to touch upon the response of the public to the lockdown, because I have felt a lot of disappointment at the fact that there is still large levels of support for the lockdown. There hasn't been a huge amount of pushback against it, although I'm heartened by polls which seem to suggest that people find a way around the rules when they have to, when it impedes them from going to work or visiting a loved one. And you know, those positive expressions of human connection and human need. What do you think explains the passive response that we've seen from sections of the population? Do you think it's because the belief in freedom had already been quite severely corroded prior to this crisis? Or do you think it points to the success of the politics of terror, essentially, or at least the politics of fear that has come from the government and large sections of the media? I mean, anyone who watches 24-hour rolling news, either back in April or right now at the moment, will just be continually horrified by the stories that we are being told and the daily announcements of death tolls. Do you think this is a success of the contemporary project fear, or do you think it points to a deeper malaise in British society?
I suspect that those who launched the campaign to make us afraid didn't understand how successful they were going to be. I think they were surprised at their success. I've often argued about fear with people. You can't make people afraid of committing crimes. So, which you should, because fear, certainly in my own life, has been an extremely important thing. I'm glad that I felt it on certain occasions, and it's an immensely powerful changer of behavior and an attitude, and anybody who pretends that it isn't is lying to themselves. And we know from that great SAGE document that was released right back on March 23rd that it was decided that people weren't scared enough, so they were going to scare them more. And you look at the character of the announcements made, the colors used on the posters, the latest bus shelter posters, which I've been seeing in Oxford, in which you're pretty much sure if you go out, people will die, with lurid red, almost hellish flames licking around hospital wards. If what you want to do is engender a lot of fear, then they're very well designed to do it. And the message has been, and I, a lot of people I know who I had and strive still to have great respect for have completely bought this and they're afraid. They stay at home, they don't go out, they cross the street to avoid breathing air that someone else has breathed within 5 minutes, all this stuff. And these are, in many cases, people with one or two university degrees and long experience of life, and yet they've fallen for it. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because I'm partly Cornish or something. Whatever it is, I don't get this. Though I am a state-registered coward, I'm very, very much afraid if I hear guns firing off or stuff like that. The first thing I would do is run, and I'm not making myself to be physically courageous. It just hasn't done it for me. But fear is immensely effective. But it's also, it's a bit like necromancy. Amateurs, if they get hold of the right book and read out the right words, can summon out of the depths, can't they, some horrible monster of fear in the human mind. But can they get it go back in again? I mean, they can. And the other thing it reminds me of enormously is the First World War. When to get people worked up in favor of this mad project, the government put out all kinds of propaganda about Germans catching babies on their bayonets and the rest of it. And they managed to stoke up a level of hatred and fear of the enemy, which was so strong that when 1916-17 came round, and the Somme had failed and Verdun had happened, and there were, the casualty lists were intolerable, and rationing was on the way, and the U-boats were sinking all the food ships, and it was, and Lord Lansdowne, a former Tory foreign secretary, wrote a letter to the Times saying, on every other previous occasion when the great powers of the world have been at each other's throats to this extent, they've come to a point where they've decided it was better to sue for peace and have a negotiated peace. And here he was, a perfectly respectable Tory, writing to the Times. The Times refused to publish his letter. This event actually features in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, as the point at which conservatism died in modern politics. They couldn't, because they had raised the fury of the population, they couldn't negotiate a peace. And because they didn't negotiate a peace in 1916-17, we got the Bolshevik Revolution, and we got Hitler, and we got Mussolini, and all the other things which destroyed Europe and the world in subsequent years, because people had made it impossible for themselves by whipping up too strong a public feeling. They weren't free anymore to go back. And I think this lot aren't free to go back either.
That's a very good point. In relation to not publishing things because they're no longer conducive to the climate that has been whipped up, you have some experience of that yourself in recent months, because social media, the social media oligarchies, the unaccountable, unelected billionaires who control vast swathes of the internet, have taken to removing from the internet anything which they judge to be overly COVID skeptical, or they would call it COVID denialism, which very often boils down to people raising questions about the lockdown. I know that videos, including you, have been taken down from YouTube. Talk radio was suspended for a few hours, which I thought was an extraordinary step, even by YouTube's standards. And the left, with great folly, I think, has been cheering this on, suddenly becoming overnight converts to the right of capitalist elites to control public discussion. How worried are you about that going ahead, about the role of these new oligarchies in controlling what we can say and fundamentally how we think?
It's terrifying. And people say, oh, well, that's not censorship, it's just a private company. Honestly, if you believe that, you'll believe anything. It's a distinction without a difference. If on what is effectively the only platform of its kind, you're prevented from expressing your opinion globally, if that's not censorship, what is? Why do people even bother to pretend otherwise? And of course, the funny thing is that while talk radio, because the government were embarrassed by what had happened and sprang to their defense, talk radio is back on the other. There is stuff, recordings of me talking to Mike Graham on talk radio, which have been taken down on my blog, but which is still available on talk radio's own YouTube feed, because it's a matter of power. And of course, YouTube, almost like most Americans, view Britain as an insignificant blob off the northwest coast of Europe, and about which they care very little. But obviously, if they come up against an actual government, they have to do something, and that's why they gave in on this occasion. But you can't guarantee, I don't think, that the government would always intervene in that way. So that was worrying. There was also the shadow banning, which I think I underwent from the same source a few months before. But with shadow banning, you can never be sure. It's just it's odd the way that your stuff doesn't get picked up. And then there's this very strange thing which is going on at the moment. I don't know whether it's affected you, but quite a lot of dissenting people are finding that their Twitter followers are disappearing at amazing rates, usually during the British day and the British night and the Californian day. And I have actually had messages on Twitter from people who had been and still are, in fact, my followers on Twitter, saying, how extraordinary, I've unfollowed you during the night. And I didn't do that. So who did? Who has the power to do this? And I've made a fair amount of fuss about this, and it's quite well known. One sees no great coverage of it going on. It's outside what you might call the dissident community. there really isn't any word about it. But it's a bit creepy, isn't it? What if they can do that, what else can they do? You have to ask yourself, if whoever it is who's doing it, no one's acknowledged doing it. It's just some kind of hidden hand. I shall now be accused again of being a conspiracy theorist. But there it is. If anybody else can come up with an explanation as to how one's Twitter followers would unfollow you overnight without doing so, then do let me know.
It is incredibly creepy, and bound to become creepier still once the Silicon Valley oligarchs mold with the incoming Biden administration. I think they will have an extraordinary amount of power over global debate and global thinking.
Of course, when what still regards itself as the West finally makes its peace with China, and then, as I've often described the modern world as the hideous love child of Margaret Thatcher and Deng Xiaoping, oh my prophetic soul, this is what seems to me to be coming. And note that during the some of the most intense stages of the last week's fuss over the invasion of the Capitol and everything else, that was when the last vestiges of liberty were wiped out in Hong Kong. And I tremble for Taiwan under these circumstances. I have to say, I don't know how, if Hong Kong can be effectively be benighted and pushed into the darkness without any serious resistance, then what hope for anybody else if China decides to silence and take over? It's an extremely nasty situation. I just think over the past few years, the fuss about Russia is collapsing, ramshackle state with the GDP of Italy as the great threat to our freedom. Oh, come on. I mean, not very nice, but it, compared with China, it's a poodle to a pit bull.
Absolutely. Okay, all right. My final question for you, Peter, is looking ahead, looking forward. I always try to end on a positive note, but I'm not sure that's...
No chance of that, yeah.
I'm not sure that's possible at the moment, given everything that's happening. But the thing we're now being told all the time is that there is light at the end of the tunnel in relation to the rollout of the vaccine and this vast national project to get everyone vaccinated as soon as possible. But the thing is, that might help to lift some of the current restrictions, but there won't be a light at the end of the tunnel, will there? Because firstly, the ongoing impact of the lockdown measures will be felt for years and years to come. But more importantly, the ongoing impact of the weaponization of fear, the disappearance of freedom, and the decay of institutions is not something that will be fixed by a jab in the arm.
It doesn't feel that way. It's interesting, despite the fact that so many people have now been vaccinated, and the numbers seem to be, it appears to be one of those rare government projects so far, touching wood here, successful. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely no sign of any let up in the frenzy. On the contrary, you hear the usual people in the media are beginning to push the idea of masks in the streets and stuff of this kind. And I sense that we'll be lucky to reach May without having had a kind of Melbourne-style home imprisonment with this lot in charge. And I don't see the vaccination softening this. So maybe they don't believe it. I would love it. I really, really would love it if the vaccination was successfully given, if millions of people got it, if this was followed by a huge drop in the number of positives and an equally huge drop in the number of deaths and the hospitals cleared out and all the rest of it. I would absolutely rejoice. But what I'm saying, whereas these things may happen, but another excuse will be found to keep us in our serfdom. And I've ceased to rely on government promises of being free. I do so very much hope that I'm wrong. But may God bless the vaccine. If it can get us out of this, if it can get us out of this, even if it can't get us out of this, let it at least be successful. But at the end of this, I don't think we're going to find that we're back in anything remotely resembling what I would regard as normal.
Peter Hitchens, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe, and in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.